Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what schools do when they get threats of violence, which they got a lot of last week.
And why a former Republican congressman from Arizona is leading an effort to push back against election conspiracy theories.
But first, the Federal Reserve yesterday cut interest rates by 0.5%. It was the first rate cut in 4 years and likely won't be the last this year. Even though the Feds had signaled they were planning to cut the rate, many observers were caught off guard a bit by its size. With me to talk about how the lower interest rate may impact Arizona and its economy is Jim Rounds with Rounds Consulting. And Jim, how big of an impact might this rate cut have here in Arizona?
Well, there's two things to think about. One is, what is the impact of a 0.5% reduction in the rate? And everybody was expecting 0.25%. They call it 0.25%, but most people think of it in percent terms. Well, because the market's already adjusted for what they were thinking, they thought it was going to be 0.25%. And then they decided to reduce it by 0.5%. It meant that it caught some people off guard, and they haven't already done some planning for that yet. So it's still going to have a little bit of an impact. Now, it's going to reduce mortgage rates. It's going to reduce the cost of borrowing. And what that does is it makes it less costly when you want to borrow to get a car or your credit card payments, things like that. The problem, though, is they kept rates zero for so long, raised it really quickly to a really high level, that coming down by 0.5% isn't going to have as big of an impact on the economy as you would normally see. It has to come down quite a bit further. But they did something that was very different than before. And I don't know if you remember the old Greenspan days, mm-hmm. where there's always jokes about if he rubbed his left ear, it meant that they were going to reduce things by 0.25%. There were all these weird like conspiracy theories and signals, but he actually did a good job signaling. This Federal Reserve Board did a terrible job of signaling. And then they come out yesterday and they say, we're not just reducing rates by 0.5% at this meeting. We're looking to reduce it by 0.5% by the end of this calendar year. And then they're looking to reduce it by another 0.5% the next year, and then maybe another 0.5%. So they just went from being very conservative with reducing rates to being probably overly aggressive. Now, when you have that happen, that's when people that are, I say stuck, but they're very fortunate. A lot of people got mortgage rates around 3.5%.
Yeah.
And they can't move, because why would they move and give up that favorable interest rate? Well, when the interest rate comes down, you're going to see more of those people with a low mortgage rates decide to maybe it's time to move up into a more expensive home. That then opens up a lower price home for somebody else. And so you end up with housing prices declining. But it's not even that simple, because as the economy gets picked up a little bit by these reduced rates, housing prices are going to go up, but the mortgage rates are going to go down, and the mortgage rates are going to go down by more than the housing prices are going to go up. So it'll net benefit the housing market, but it's going to take a while.
So I wanted to ask you about housing, because for the longest time, as you alluded to, we've been hearing about how there just isn't really much of a supply of existing homes, because people who are living in them don't want to sell because they're not going to get an interest rate as good as what they have now. It sounds like what you're saying is this might sort of unstick some of that supply, which maybe in theory could help perhaps new home buyers or people looking to get into the market.
It'll unstick some of the supply, but we're further challenged when you have the current economic conditions. It's a combination of current economic conditions, to some extent, the extent that government restricts development or maybe has too high development fees. There's a lot of things the government does on the like the zoning side, and there's a lot of stuff that they do on this macro side, like what the Federal Reserve Board does. So a lot of things led to what is going on with housing right now. So with people being able to move up out of their 3.5% mortgage rates into something else in the next couple of years, you will have additional homes freed up for people that maybe are in that lower to middle income area. But the lower income housing always needs to be subsidized, or you need major changes in the way restrictions are applied to homes on smaller lots and things like that.
You mentioned that this will make it less expensive to borrow money. So are you anticipating that people who have been putting off larger purchases might be inclined to make them now?
Well, they might, but I think it's going to end up being, rather than seeing this cause a little bit of an economic boom, it's going to be lessening the decline of the economy. See, we're really at the tail end of this thing. And one of the best measures is you take a look at the U.S. Jobs report that comes out every month, where, you know, normally you would like to see job growth 200,000 to 300,000, maybe more. As you get closer to 100,000 a month, you get into that kind of sketchy territory. Well, we actually went below that 1 month, and we've been close to 100,000 within the last 3 months. So we have this trend of job growth going down. We have inflation going down, which would normally be a positive. But in this economic environment, prices have gotten so high, unless inflation goes negative, we're not going to see overall price declines. People don't care about the inflation percentage. They care about how much things cost. All this is really going to do is it's not going to be boosting things. It will, for somebody that's been in the market for maybe getting a new car or even a used car, concerned about the interest rates being too high, they'll see a little bit of relief. But we're not going to see just an economic boom. This is really to stabilize the decline. But what they're doing differently is they're being extremely aggressive, which makes my previous prediction of this being a very mild downturn for the U.S. and for Arizona in particular, even more likely. And so even though I think the Federal Reserve Board messed up greatly by the way they managed the period after COVID, keeping two rates for too low for too long and then raising them so rapidly, that gives them a little bit more ammunition to fight against a severe economic downturn.
Interesting. Well, so you mentioned inflation. That, of course, has been on the minds of a lot of people around the country and around Arizona. Do you anticipate that this rate cut will have a significant impact on inflation, like to the point where people will notice things being different?
I think they'll notice it in the report. So when they hear that inflation maybe went up a little bit from closer to 2% to 3%, because this will push inflation up a little bit, they'll at least hear that. You don't notice those smaller changes every day at the grocery store or when you're buying a television or whatever else it is. But what you do notice is that you have to have inflation in negative values in order for prices to come down. So people are still going to be noticing that they're paying a lot more for everyday items, even though people are saying, but inflation's in check. This will cause inflation to go up, but it will also make it where the job numbers that are declined, that are falling below 100,000, which is my worry point, it might push those up a little bit. And again, the target is a soft landing. The plane's coming down towards the runway. Do you want it to slam into the runway, or do you want it to like gradually drift into it? And that's what they're trying to do. But I still don't understand why they decided to tell everybody we're going to be cutting rates like crazy for the rest of this year, all of next year, and then half of the year after that. They don't know. I mean, that's like Greenspan tugging on his ear, scratching his nose, you know, taking off his jacket, putting it back on. This normally doesn't happen. And it's a little bit amateurish, but it's also consistent with what they've been doing since this COVID recession issue.
Interesting. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Jim Rounds with Rounds Consulting Group. Jim, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Take care.
Last week, following the shooting that killed four people at a Georgia high school, schools across the valley saw a wave of threats. Officials said much of it stemmed from a Snapchat post, and none of them were found to be credible. But still, schools alerted parents and some students and raised the alarm that law enforcement were looking into the threats and that they had been made. Many parents kept their kids home as a precaution. So when does a school send out that kind of shockwave into the community? What is their protocol when they receive a threat? To find out more, I spoke with Jason Yeager, Director of Safety Operations at the Dysart Unified School District in the West Valley.
Typically, it's just to try to find the source, try to figure out if the reporter that sent it to us knows who sent it, if they saw it through a third party, social media, something like that. Because our immediate desire is just to try to figure out the validity of it. And the quickest way to figure out if it's true or not is to determine who it was that posted it. So that's step one.
Okay. So before you inform anyone or, you know, talk to law enforcement, you're going to kind of look at who posted it, who sent it to you, and try to track it down. Do you get a ton of these? Is that why it's not like an immediate, you know, level 100 reaction?
You know, I wouldn't say we get a ton. They obviously come in spurts. But the reason why is that certainly when we go to law enforcement, they need a certain amount of information as well. Mm. And so if being former law enforcement, knowing that they're going to need some level of information in order to start their investigation, we have to start to try to get them at least half of the five W's, right, in order for them to know where they're going to go with it. Typically, they circle back to us and see what ways we can help with our resources. But also, we know our students and our community sometimes, you know, better, certainly our students better than they would. So it helps for us to be able to give them that background.
Yeah. Okay. So you'll do some digging on your own. How do you sort of assess at that level what threat to take seriously and what one is a joke that, you know, you might get in trouble for, but certainly isn't going to raise the level of awareness that you need to take it to law enforcement?
Well, I mean, we put them all on the same pathway. So we have just our internal investigations through our administrators and then through our safety team. But then we also have our threat assessment processes. And there's a long version and a short version of that. And it kind of depends on what information comes out to which way we go. And so kind of alluding to what you mentioned, some of them are just, you know, kids saying things that they really shouldn't say or didn't understand the gravity of it versus something that we think might need some extra attention. And so that initial kind of assessment of that statement or whatever it is that we're reading or what have you is what kind of drives that.
I want to ask about when you said that these threats kind of come in spurts, right? Was it surprising to you at all that there were a lot of threats on social media last week against many, many schools throughout the Valley following this very high profile school shooting that happened in Georgia?
You know, I think the timing was, I guess, disappointing is the right word. We did receive threats like this in previous years. Typically, they surround like the end of the year when kids are trying to get out of testing or other things. I think the fact that these arose after a real scenario just made it a little bit more urgent on our part to make sure that we got it right. And so I would say that last week's were probably more stressful than they've been in the past, but they're not unexpected.
Okay. So talk a little bit about how you communicate something like this. So I have a kid in an elementary school in the Valley, and I got simultaneously last week a phone call, a text message, and an email from the district saying, you know, here's what we know. Here's what you can do. Not a ton, you know, but there was a lot of communication to parents. How do you kind of inform parents and teachers and the community? Do you tell kids?
So, yeah, I mean, there's a hierarchy of the information channel and so forth, but kind of the same way that you experienced it. Our official communication channels are those things that you mentioned, the email, the phone, the text messages. When we send something out on those channels, our parents have an understanding that that's going to be the most accurate information that we have at this time. And so we try to make sure that we're factual. We try to make sure that we're timely and that we're being transparent. But at the same token, these are still being investigated. So typically what we'll say is, you know, we know these have come out. We've either looped in law enforcement or, you know, maybe the investigation's already been complete at this point. It kind of depends on how long it takes. But our first priority is just to make sure that our kids are safe. And so once we know that at least we're in a position to where that has occurred, then we go ahead and put out the messaging. Yes, we're aware of this. This is where we're at. And then, you know, obviously try to provide updates as required. But it is tricky on kind of balancing, you know, when is the appropriate time? How much information do we have? And, you know, what information are we ready to put out?
Yeah, yeah. Do you inform students at the same time, or especially at the elementary level, do you really not want to tell them?
You know, we did high schools this last time because that's where the majority of the reports were coming in from.
Right.
So I think we take that case by case. To your point, there is a level of understanding or ability to have that information sink in at those different age levels. But we take that case by case. Certainly, if it was something that came through, like in a third or a fifth grade, and we still have those discussions, especially if it's a discussion that needs to be had of, hey, let us do our work. You're safe right now. You know, we're talking to your parents. There's still room for age-appropriate discussions, but we certainly drive those based on the target audience.
That's really interesting. Did you see a lot of parents last week take their kids out of school or keep them home because of these alerts going out and media reports about it?
We did. And despite our best messaging, and I get it, parents are going to do what they believe is best for their kids. And we certainly understand that. But there was a significant number of kids that stayed home on that day.
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit about your role here. Did you mention your former law enforcement? When was this position created?
This position was created actually, I think, before COVID, but there were some changes to it since then. I accepted the job almost 3 years ago now. I worked for the state police prior to that, retired from there, and came straight into this position.
What do you think? I mean, it's a little bit existential, but I wonder, like, what you think about the fact that we're living in a time in which a position like this is necessary. Like, is most of your job dealing with threats like this, with preventing violence on campus?
It's really not. And I think that as much as more and more people and districts are finding this position important because of those things, mm-hmm. I think from a just being prepared and a knowledge standpoint, what I find more often than not is the programs and the policies that I help to implement. Staff is very appreciative of those because they just don't typically have that same type of perspective. It just isn't their area of expertise. And so you see from the top down, the Department of Education has minimum standards for emergency preparedness. And it's great that they have those, but if you don't have somebody who can interpret those and teach them properly back at the district level, they may not work as effectively as they could. And so I think by having someone that has that understanding, it just makes those messages more effective. It is great that these positions are being added to combat some of these more recent types of issues that are facing schools. But I think it's really important with or without them.
Interesting. Let me ask you lastly about the kind of worst case scenario stuff. Like, what levels of protection exist in schools in your district, at least in terms of if this got further, if it became more serious, if law enforcement told you, you know, yes, we think this is a credible threat. Do you have lockdown systems? I know there are drills. Are there, you know, other layers in place?
Yeah. And we don't typically get into the specifics of all the things we have just to make sure that we keep them as safe as possible. But we do. We approach it from a multi-layered system. And so we try to do that in as many disciplines as possible, whether it be communication, whether it be, you know, hardening of our schools and our fence lines, whether it be personnel like our SROs and our security guards, but certainly policies, drills, all those things key into it. But we're always looking to improve. I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, there's hundreds of vendors looking to sell districts safety-related items. And we try to look at what's best for our district, what's best for our community, and how they are able to react to these things. But I think it's a moving target, and we're always trying to get better at it.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Jason Yeager, Director of Safety Operations at Dysart Unified School District, joining us. Jason, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, stand-up comedian and podcaster Mark Maron uses vulnerability to elevate his humor.
If you've got something that's stuck in you, you know, from childhood or from pain or from tragedy or from grief, and there's some little key that makes you laugh at it, that does wonders to integrate it into the wholeness of your being, you know?
We'll hear more about how Maron turns tragedy into comedy.
But first, a group of Arizona Republicans is working to counter the narrative from former President Trump and others that elections are rigged. The Democracy Defense Project aims to, quote, defend the transparency, safety, security, and validity of Arizona's election system and restore voter confidence. The effort includes former Governor Jan Brewer, as well as my next guest, former Congressman Matt Salmon. Salmon says there are lots of Republicans who share his belief that elections are run fairly and administered properly, but that some have been reluctant to say so out of a fear of retribution. I spoke with Salmon earlier, and we started the conversation with to what he attributes the fact that there are people who don't think elections are run fairly and that the people who are administering them are cheating.
I think that today there are a number of people that are concerned about the security of our elections because the former president of the United States and one of our leading candidates here in Arizona who ran for governor seemed to foment those arguments, those thoughts. And I think a lot of people have bought into it because the argument doesn't seem to just go away.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, you're referencing, of course, Carrie Lake, who's now running for U.S. Senate, and former President Trump, who, of course, is running to be elected back to the White House. You, of course, are a Republican yourself and a pretty conservative one at that. You're working with former Governor Brewer, Jonathan Lyons, former chair of the state Republican Party. I'm wondering, like, where this leaves you in the GOP in Arizona right now, going with this effort, considering who's sort of top of the ticket in the state.
Well, you mentioned that I'm a conservative, and I don't think whether you're conservative, moderate, or liberal has anything to do with whether or not you accept truth versus fiction. Yeah, I'm very, very conservative in where I stand on the policy line. I've always been very, very conservative. I still am, but I don't subscribe to things that aren't true.
Obviously, I'm not going to ask you who you're voting for. That's not my business. But I'm curious how you personally try to mesh how you feel about elections and how you feel about policy issues with the people who are running as Republicans leading the ticket for president and U.S. Senate, who on policy issues, I would imagine there are a lot of things with which you agree, but not the election issue.
Yeah. For me, there are people that are running that advocate, different thoughts on the election than I do. And thank heavens, this is a free country and they have the right to speak in a free way and to advocate the things that they want to. I think it's irresponsible to advocate that our elections are not secure and that they're unsafe, or that elections in our country don't account for the votes in the right way. I think that hurts a person's confidence in the process, and I think that's sad. And I think that people who run for office and try to destroy people's belief in our constitutional democracy, I think that's very, very troublesome in my view.
I'm curious how big of an issue you think this is going to be in 2024. I mean, for example, we saw Stephen Richer, the Maricopa County Recorder, who has defended the county's elections, lost to an election skeptic. At the presidential debate, former President Trump continued to say that he won in 2020 and that the vote was stolen. We continue to see these kinds of statements, these kinds of efforts to, for example, hand count ballots and not use the vote counting machines. How big of an issue do you think this is going to continue to be?
I think that as each election happens, the number of people that subscribe to the idea that, you know, that, as you mentioned, individuals who are election deniers, I think that they're going to shrink because there are a lot more people that are willing to stand up, even, you know, within my party and counter those arguments. But right now, it's still pretty prevalent. There's still a lot of people that agree with the viewpoints of the former president of the United States. And you mentioned in the debate, he said that. I was disappointed that he said that. And there are other candidates that continue to make that an issue in their campaigns. And right now in Arizona, it's still an issue and it's still a problem. It's a serious problem. It hasn't gone away. And that's why I think it necessitates us doing what we're doing to try to counter those arguments and let people know that the elections are safe and secure. Their vote does count because that counter narrative is harmful to the whole democratic process.
So I guess that kind of begs the question. I mean, if you are going to sort of, whatever analogy you want to use, break the fever, you know, move on from this, turn the page, however you want to describe it. Like, I guess, how do you do that? Like, how do you do that with former President Trump still leading the ticket and still being a major force in Republican politics and others who subscribe to these kinds of things also being pretty significant forces in the GOP?
As long as the leaders of the Republican Party continue to espouse the election denialism and things that aren't true, we're going to keep losing. And maybe when the Republican Party has lost enough, I think that's already happened. But, you know, today as we look forward to the election in just a few short weeks, you know, a lot of people are kind of holding their breath, wondering if there's a possibility that Republicans will lose control, the majority control of the state legislature, or lose it in one of the bodies. I believe we've already hit rock bottom, you know, as far as our election chances, our election successes in the last few election cycles. I believe we've already hit rock bottom. Maybe we haven't. Maybe, you know, with a lot of people, there's going to have to be a lot more losses before they'll change the things that they want to talk about in elections. As long as we keep talking in general elections about stolen elections, and we don't concern ourselves with future policies and making our state and our country a better place to live, as long as we keep focusing on the past and fiction, I think we're going to keep losing.
Is there a danger, though, do you think, in terms of sort of relying on people to maybe wake up after losing election after election to stop thinking that there are problems with elections? I wonder if it's maybe in some ways a reinforcing cycle where if Republicans continue to lose, it becomes easier for Republicans to say, well, we keep losing, not because the elections aren't rigged, but because they are. We need to keep talking about it.
Yeah, there is a real risk. And that's a really, really good point. There's a risk that people will dig deeper and deeper into those beliefs, and it will continue to cost us at the election ballot.
All right. That is former Arizona Congressman Matt Salmon, now working with the Democracy Defense Project. Thanks so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. There is a rematch happening this election season in Southern Arizona's 6th Congressional District between Republican incumbent Juan Ciscomani and the Democratic challenger he narrowly beat 2 years ago, Kirsten Engel. This time around, like many politicians on both sides of the aisle, Engel's campaign is focusing on reproductive rights, and Ciscomani is focusing on the economy and border security. And they're both focusing on how those issues play with specifically Latina voters, according to our next guest. Leon Krause is a global opinions contributing columnist for The Washington Post. He spent some time traveling around CD6 recently, talking to Latina voters. And as he recently wrote in the Post, what he heard, he says, should serve as a warning to Democrats.
I think that Kirsten Engel has a very clear idea that the last few years since the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade have been very difficult in Arizona, and that women in Arizona have faced the threat of a series of very punitive bans that have brought this issue to the forefront, and that a whole generation of young women in Arizona, Latina women from similar minorities, have been specifically affected by these sort of bans. Not only the threat of it in Arizona, but in other states, and that's why she has taken this issue and made it her main banner. Ciscomani, on the other hand, I think realizes, he insists that he knows the district very well. Of course, any politician would say that, but he says that. And according to him, what he hears time and time again is that the priority for voters is the economy and border security rather than reproductive freedom. He recognizes that abortion is important, but I keep hearing about the economy and about border security. That's what he told me repeatedly in the interview we had.
Yeah. And when it comes specifically to courting Latino and Latina voters, as you pointed out, that's really interesting. So let's talk about some of the people that you met, these voters you met as you sort of traveled around this district. You were in Tucson. You were in more rural parts of the state as well, talking to people who kind of fit that profile. Tell us about what they had to say.
It was fascinating. First of all, the difference between, and this isn't really surprising, but to see it in the flesh was revealing. The difference between people around Tucson and the suburban area of Tucson and people farther south, like around Benson, for example, was very striking, right? I mean, the priorities for the Latina voters that I found were very, very different. The students that I interviewed in a couple of campuses that I went to of Pima Community College, most of them agreed that the main issue was reproductive freedom. But when you go to Benson, there I met a young mother. She said, listen, I'm a Christian, and for me, abortion just shouldn't happen. And what I care about is the economy and border issues. So I think that's where the election will be decided in the 6th district. And frankly, could happen in all of Arizona and maybe even the country.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely emblematic of a bigger picture here. Tell us about this specific exchange you wrote about where you were talking to a young Latina and her father kind of jumped in, right? Which said a lot, I think.
Yeah, that was fascinating. I met this young Latina who was there with her father, and she very clearly said that, I mean, she was very sophisticated. She had an opinion on most issues, but she told me, listen, for me, reproductive freedom is the most important issue. And as I was walking away, her father, a 72-year-old Hispanic man who was born in Mexico, a Mexican immigrant, started screaming, Trump, Trump, Trump. And I obviously went back and said, wait, tell me, why are you yelling Mr. Trump's name? And then he said, listen, I'm going to vote for Trump. And they got into an argument, both of them, on reproductive freedom and abortion. He was much more conservative. She described a bunch of counter arguments. And it was just so fascinating, so revealing to see them go back and forth. Because again, this paints a picture of also a generational divide, a gender divide that is on display there in Arizona and again elsewhere.
Yeah, and all within the Latino community there. I want to talk about immigration for a moment in particular, because what you heard from folks and the way these campaigns are approaching the Latino vote on the border about immigration is so interesting. Because I think at one point we would have expected most Latinos to vote Democratic, right? Mm-hmm. Because of immigration. Mm-hmm. But that's definitely not what you're hearing from a lot of folks today. And we've seen this trend in the broader Latino vote. Tell us about what you heard from folks on the border.
I think that in general, I mean, in my experience, not only in my recent trip to Arizona, but in general, I think that the country is moving towards a more restrictive immigration approach. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's moving to the right, it's moving to a conservative position. I'd rather say it's moving towards a more restrictive approach. And I clearly saw that in Arizona. I mean, even progressive voters, even voters who were clearly going to vote for Kamala Harris, acknowledged to me, and young voters acknowledged to me, that this is a serious issue. I mean, most people would say that not all immigrants are bad people. There are many, many, many good people coming in, but there's also the threat of bad people coming in. So, I mean, there were nuanced positions, and for everyone I spoke to in Arizona, immigration is an important issue. The question is whether or not it will be a decisive issue in the election, but that it's important, I have absolutely no doubt.
Yeah. Let me end with one final question here about sort of your warning, I think, for Democrats that you wrote in this column, right? They're expecting to win in states like Arizona because of abortion rights, they say. Tell us a little bit about your caution there.
Well, it comes rather from my reporting, because what I found is that even voters whom you would be single issue voters, mm-hmm. or very clearly had already decided to vote for the Democratic option because of the issue of reproductive freedom, all of them again manifested other concerns. And I think those other concerns are important enough and weigh on them enough for this equation to offer a warning for the Democratic Party, because I do think that the key to winning the state, the district, the state, and elsewhere is to balance the message. Don't trust that reproductive freedom, however important, and it's incredibly important, mm-hmm. and salient of an issue, will carry the day and the election. The message has to be more complex than that, let me put it that way.
That was my conversation with Washington Post Global Opinions contributing columnist Leon Krause about his take on Latino voters in CD6. And this is The Show. Good morning. It is The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. I'm joined now in the studio by The Show's Sam Dingman. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Mark. You know, as happens from time to time here on the show, recently I got the chance to talk to one of my heroes, Mark Maron. You're familiar with his work as well, if I'm not mistaken.
His stand-up comedian's got a very popular podcast called WTF.
That's right. WTF has been running since 2009, gets millions of downloads every week. I'm not ashamed to admit I have never missed an episode. But I'm also a huge fan of Marin's stand-up comedy, and I have been particularly interested in his more recent material. Last year, he released an HBO special called From Bleak to Dark, and it got a lot of critical acclaim for this one sequence where he talks about the death of his girlfriend, the filmmaker Lynn Shelton. In particular, there's this one moment where he talks about how surreal it felt to grieve Lynn's loss.
I'm just sitting on my porch, and a hummingbird came right up to my head, just like, and I'm like, oh my God, Lynn! Lynn, you're a hummingbird now. Of course you are. That makes so much sense. I miss you, baby. I can't believe you're a hummingbird. What's that like? That's crazy. And then the next day, there were like four hummingbirds. And I'm like, what the fuck is happening? Which one is Lynn? Who's Lynn? Is this like Lynn and her new dead friends? Is this what happened?
Now, obviously, I was already in the tank for Marin, and I've always found his work to be just as emotionally rich as it is hilarious. But that moment in the special kind of made me feel like he'd found a new gear.
That is interesting. He is coming to Phoenix this weekend. He'll be performing at the Orpheum Theater. Sam, as you mentioned, got a chance to catch up with him earlier this week. Let's take a listen.
You know, I feel like I heard you mention on the show not so long ago that this current run of stand-up that you're doing, building up to your next special.
Yeah.
Might potentially be your last run?
You know, I say that, I think, all the time, you know, as sort of a preparation for when I actually mean it. Mm-hmm. After a certain point, because of the way I do stand up, I just get concerned that, you know, the resource of me is going to dry up at some point.
Sure. Well, let me ask you more about that. I'm really fascinated by what you said about this idea of whether or not the self is a renewable resource, because you've always spoken very personally, but
yeah,
more and more so in your recent work, there's been this vulnerability to it. And I'm thinking in particular, obviously, of in your most recent special, From Bleak to Dark,
yeah,
talking about your grief about losing Lynn and the hummingbird moment. And I know that in this current hour, if I'm not mistaken, you're talking very openly about some potentially traumatic stuff from childhood. Does that feel like a different register for you than where you've been previously?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it seems to be like the new frontier on some level. I think talking about grief and tragedy in Bleak to Dark just sort of gave me some sort of portal into knowing that I could elevate other things that were, you know, utterly personal or painful and bring them to a point of humor. I know, like, it's a buzzword, you know, vulnerability, authenticity, you know, trauma talk or whatever.
Yeah.
But I also think it's kind of loaded in a way that is truly kind of risk-taking and truly kind of edgy. But I think ultimately, if you've got something that's stuck in you, you know, from childhood or from pain or from tragedy or from grief, and there's some little key that makes you laugh at it, that does wonders to integrate it into the wholeness of your being, you know?
Yeah. Well, so can I ask you, and you don't have to go into any more detail, I don't want to ruin the show, obviously, but in terms of this material that you're working with in the current hour, did you find that you were able to experience these memories in a comedic sense for the first time on stage?
Well, no, because, you know, me and my, you know, my brother had talked about it for a long time here and there. And, you know, the outcome of it, I think I have a brain that is constantly in a state of, you know, mild panic, mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, manufactures crisis as a way of self-soothing. I make myself a little crazy with it all, you know. But I recently realized that when you have that kind of brain, when an actual crisis happens, you're kind of ready to go, you know. So,
so fringe benefit maybe.
Yeah, but my point is that I chose a long time ago, you know, to stay away from, you know, topicality in a broad sense, because you'll notice that, you know, the way comics handle, certainly the anti-woke comics, you know, handle what they consider edgy material is essentially just reconfiguring talking points, you know, kind of like, hey, we can't say anything anymore. And so for me, the only way to kind of move against being a hack in that way seems to be like going inside to myself and talking about how I think and what I think about and my experience. That's really the only way to go to maintain originality. So
absolutely,
that's where I'm at.
Well, and there's a big difference between, you know, throwing this word vulnerability around. There's a big difference between the kind of anti-woke comic you're talking about, claiming that they are making themselves vulnerable by, in their minds, exposing themselves to cancellation, versus you actually being vulnerable in processing this traumatic experience in a comedic way that people may not have seen before. That's a very different version of vulnerability.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I always saw being a stand-up as being, you know, something more than an entertainer. And it is sort of like, you know, I do think about the world constantly. I am constantly engaged with the news. I'm constantly engaged with myself and where I'm at in my life. And so it all kind of, you know, moves together.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting hearing you characterize it that way because, you know, in getting ready to talk to you today, I was thinking about one of my favorite, like, Marc Maron sort of political jokes ever, when this is a very old one, but the joke was, you always think the sound of Big Brother is going to be this like big booming voice, but the sound of Big Brother is just some guy going like, hey, check it out, my phone has GPS.
Yeah.
Still one of my favorite Marc Maron jokes. But I was trying to think about, like, why did that joke work so well for me? And I think it was because, and tell me if you agree with this, if memory serves, it comes in the context of you being at, I think it's like the Creationism Museum, and being annoyed at people in line being idiots with their phones. So it's like the joke lands because it comes in the context of this very personal experience that you've had.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the way I process everything. And I had to honor that point of view in my comedy. You know, like, look, you know, there's guys who have personas, and I don't know that I have one. And it used to really bother me, and I'd be like, how do I get a persona? You know, but I think the struggle has always been to be me, and I'm pretty painfully me.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things, I guess, that has been fascinating to me about this thing that I hear you saying is sometimes how you feel and sometimes not how you feel in terms of, are you coming to the end of the time when you want to be doing this, is just in relation to what you were saying about stand-up and the desire to be more than just an entertainer. What do you feel like stand-up is fulfilling for you now?
You know, there was always sort of this drive, you know, to get the new joke, to figure out a new thing, and I was always like, you know, really intent on, you know, making people see things the way I did or see things differently or blowing minds or coming up with a new bit. So there is always an element of discovery that is sort of unparalleled by any other experience in life, because I do generate, you know, live on stage most of the time. So it's sort of delivered to me by something I don't really understand. And that, you know, is a creative catharsis that is still available to me. And I think as long as it's available to me and it continues to happen, you know, I'll continue doing it.
Yeah.
Like that bit that we were talking about earlier, that point of view around technology and around our surrender of our own minds, you know, still holds. I'm doing a bit now that I'm working on about how I believe no matter, you know, what your life looks like or what your personal life looks like, that I'd argue that your primary emotional partner is probably your phone.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was thinking about, you know, if I was to think of the broad arc of Marc Maron politics throughout your work, the thing that's always resonated for me, at least, is that it always feels like you're talking about what has power over us and how we give it that power. And it's occurring to me as we're talking that in a way there's a real continuity between the idea that sometimes the thing you're giving power to is a government or a politician or a certain type of comedy or a device, but that as you begin to integrate more of your own emotional experience, it's also acknowledging that sometimes you're giving your trauma power over you, or sometimes you're navigating the power that your trauma has over you. So there is kind of a continuity there.
Yeah. So sadly, though, you know, pushing back on power outside of you, you know, is easier than pushing back on power inside of you. And sometimes you, you know, you're going to buckle to that inner one, and it can really screw your life up for as long as it takes, maybe forever.
All right. Well, Mark Maron will be at the Orpheum Theater here in Phoenix this Saturday. Mark, thank you so much for taking this time. I appreciate it.
Great job, buddy. I enjoyed it. Thanks, man.
All right, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. We've got the Friday News Cap coming up. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.